Hello, everyone. You're listening to the Words of the Wise podcast, hosted by me, Lexi Maynard. Our mission is to capture the words and wisdom of the world's elderly so that their story and legacy may last forever. Like what we're about? Then be sure to subscribe to receive instant updates on new episodes. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram at Words of the Wise Podcast, or on Twitter at Words of W Podcast as well. This episode features Mr. Dennis Wilson. Dennis is the grandfather of one of my best friends, Haley. She always talks about how close her relationship is with him, so hearing his story was an awesome experience. Without further ado, here is Dennis Wilson, episode number 32.
Hello, I'm Dennis Wilson. I'm 75 years old.
All right. And so we're going to start off with talking about your childhood. So just to get like your background information, what were your parents like?
Okay. My father came from a family of nine. He was the next youngest. He had four sisters and four brothers. And he was being raised by his father and mother. And in 1923, his father and grandfather had returned from Muncie, and at that time they had an old automobile. And between Albany and Eaton, they had what was called the traction line. It was just before Christmas, and evidently they didn't see the traction line coming, so the car hit him. It was like a train, and killed both of them. From that point on, he kind of raised himself, well, along with his brothers and sisters. So he started out, you know, at a very young age, having a lot of responsibility. My mother was born to a lady who died later from childbirth, and she was raised by her grandparents.
Oh my gosh.
So they kind of had a tough time growing up.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. And then how did those two meet?
They were both from Dunkirk, or he was from Dunkirk and she was at Hartford. And I don't know exactly how they got together, but I think it was from going to school together. Now, he graduated from high school where she was not able to, because here again, she was raised by her grandparents and she had to go into the workforce to help supplement the family.
Oh my goodness. So then, did your parents stay in Dunkirk then?
Actually, they moved to Albany.
Okay.
And they had my brother and my sister. And in 1944, that was when the World War II, and he enlisted in the Navy, and he was gone for 2 years. Then when he came back in 1946, I was born.
All right. So then you grew up in Albany then?
Yes.
Okay. So what was Albany like when you were growing up?
Small town. You knew everybody. Mm-hmm. You knew everybody on your street. You knew their mother, their father, the names of their kids. You knew everybody in high school. You knew everybody in grade school. Mm-hmm. And it's so different from today, where in schools the size that you and Haley went to, you don't know all the kids in your class. You don't even know their names.
Yeah. Where
you knew everybody growing up. They were all your friends. You spent days and hours with them because there wasn't a lot of other things to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what did the typical day in your childhood look like?
Most times you start out at 7 o'clock in the morning. We'd go to school, and at that time we walked to school, which was about 3 blocks, and we came home for lunch. We had lunch, went back to school, finished the school day. And as I got older, most times I would be playing either baseball or basketball for the high school, and you have baseball practice, high school basketball practice, then you go home and you do your homework and go to bed.
Mm-hmm. That was a typical day.
Typical day.
And do you have a favorite childhood memory or something that stands out to you?
I think that one of the favorite memories was, as a family, we weren't really very wealthy, nor was a lot of people at that time, but you would look forward to the vacation, which was at Little Barbie Lake, where we rent a cottage and get to spend a whole week with on the water. And the fellow that we rented the cottage from, he had a speedboat. I learned how to ski, and so we had a good time every year for that. That was our annual vacation and what we looked forward to.
Oh, that's awesome. And you actually went to the lake with your family too, right?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Yeah. Awesome. So what did the typical, we're looking at high school now, what did like the typical Saturday night in high school look like for you?
During the winter time, we starting in late October was basketball. Mm-hmm. Basketball is the most important thing in small schools. So we would normally go to the basketball game on a Saturday night. After the basketball game, the booster club allowed you $1.50, and you could go down to the truck stop, Miller's truck stop, right across Craig Trucking, and you get a hamburger, French fries, and a chocolate shake for $1.50.
Oh my god!
So that was our Saturday evening.
Oh, that sounds
after ball game.
I wish I could still get that kind of food for $1.50.
No.
Did you have a job growing up?
Several jobs. Yeah. My father, my uncle, and another gentleman, they all had factory jobs, but on the weekends and during the evenings, they also had a tree trimming and cut down trees. And although I didn't really get paid, but I was always there to help them. When they cut the trees down, then I'd pick up the branches and rake all the excess and started that. And that was just a weekend thing. As I got older, where I could actually earn money on my own, in the summertime we'd bale hay. And it was a real honor to get on a hay baling crew because you could go from one farm to the next and get paid. Plus the best part it was, you got to be fed by the family whose house that you were, or farm that you was baling at. And that was as good as the money got paid. I also, in the wintertime, we worked on a turkey farm, which was in the between Albany and Red Key, or Albany and Fairview. That was supplemental income. And then while I was in high school, after basketball practice, I would go to the bowling alley and set pins. And that was before they had automatic pin setters.
Yeah.
So actually, you were in the pit, and as the bowling ball came down and knocked down the pins, you'd have to get in them and put them in the rack and set them again. So I had a job from the time I was probably 10 years old.
Wow. I didn't even think about how the pins didn't used to be automatic.
And you had two lanes that you were setting pins and you set between. Now, these guys that throw the ball about 90 miles an hour and hit the pins, and you had to watch yourself or you get hit with the pins. But anyway, you had to jump from one side to the other and set the pins. And it would the way you could make the most money is on league night, where you would set for a league, and they'd actually give you maybe a dollar tip.
Yeah. So then, as we've been talking about your childhood and the way you were raised, what would you say is the greatest thing that your parents taught you?
At an early age, they taught you if you worked hard in school, at a part-time job, if you applied yourself in the later years when you grew up, you would know that you appreciated what a dollar was worth. And you learned how to become an adult that way.
Mm-hmm. So then, what year did you graduate from high school?
In 1964.
Okay, so then graduated in 1964 and you enrolled in Ball State, correct?
Yes.
And what made you, I know you're obviously from around there, is that why you decided to go to Ball State? Or?
Yes, yeah. A couple of different reasons. And one of the big reasons was my father passed away 3 weeks after I graduated from high school. My mother had never received a driver's license. She was always a stay-at-home mom. And she babysat and took in washing and ironing. And she really had no way to make any income. So I worked at a part-time job at the gas station to help supplement our income.
Yeah.
That's why I wouldn't want to go and live off, like on campus. So it was also because the kids that I'd graduated with, they were also going to Ball State. So we could carpool.
Yeah.
And I could be over there and be back at night to work at my part-time job.
Okay, that makes sense. So then when you were there, what was your major?
It was business administration.
Okay, and why was that?
I didn't really know. I was, but business being working at a gas station and working with people and trying to have to keep inventory, just things like that. Thought, well, that's where I'll start at it.
Yeah, yeah. And I know you were only there for like a year, right?
Right.
Before you got. So, right. Do you have any like favorite college memories from that year you were there?
I think the best memories that I have was the kids that I met while I was in college that I, you know, when you're in, from a small town, you only know the people there in the small town, but you got to gain information from other kids that you had never had any contact with. And it was interesting to see where they came from and what their stories were.
Yeah, that's my favorite part about college too. Okay, so then, like I just said, you were only there for a year, and then you were drafted, right?
No. I wasn't drafted. Okay. What happened at that time in the, I think it's 1964, 65, they reenacted the draft. So everybody who was 18 or older had to register for the draft, which I did that. Mm-hmm. And all young men did. But what happened was you had to carry a full load, a full schedule. I think it was 15 hours. And at that time, it was Ball State Teachers College, and it was on the quarter system. So you had to have at least 15 hours to get a deferment. Because I was working part-time and trying to supplement our income, my mother and I, then I only had 12 hours in the third quarter, I guess it was. So I lost my deferment. I was reclassified 1A, and I was eligible for the draft then. So that's why I did. I wasn't drafted, because I joined the Air Force.
Okay. And how old were you then, 18?
19 when
19.
I...
19. Okay, so you joined the Air Force. Why the Air Force? Why did he choose?
My wife's mother and dad, he was an Air Force veteran. He had been in the Air Force for 22 years.
Okay.
As we were dating, she lived in Lincoln, Nebraska, an Air Force base. So I went out to visit her when I was, I think, in the year after I graduated. And he showed me around the base. He told me about what he did as far as a career was concerned. And I thought, you know, if I'm going to go to the military, I'd like to be in the Air Force. Plus the fact the two guys that I worked with at the gas station there in Albany were both Air Force veterans, and they influenced me. Mm-hmm. They said, if you're going to go, do that. So I chose the Air Force. And in February of 1966, I entered the delayed enlistment program while I was still in college.
Okay. And what was your role within the Air Force?
Okay. When I enlisted, you go to a recruiter, and there's four different areas that's going to be where you will be assigned to. In other words, general, electronics, administration, or mechanical. Well, because of my background in mechanics, I was chosen, you know, that's where I was going to do. And I really thought I was going to be an aircraft mechanic. That was my desire. But at the time, they didn't need aircraft mechanics, but they did need automotive mechanics.
Okay.
So I became an automotive technician specialist. And as I progressed in the Air Force, I became in management, like a scheduler. And then I eventually became a squadron training NCO, which was for the whole squadron. So I had three different jobs.
Yeah, cool. And where were you stationed? Were you living at this time?
Myrtle Beach Air Force Base in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina.
Okay. And did you stay there the entire time, or did
yes.
you travel?
I was there from 1966 to 1970, but in 1968, we were called to Vietnam. I went to Vietnam.
Yeah, wow. And so how long did you stay in Vietnam for the entirety of the war?
A little background behind that. And normally, when you're assigned to a base, which when I was assigned to Myrtle Beach, it was kind of funny because we were in San Antonio, Texas, Lackland Air Force Base. And you would get your assignment probably about 1 week before you're released to go to your next assignment. And I got orders from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, Myrtle Beach Air Force Base. I've never been to South Carolina. I've never been to Myrtle Beach, and I had no idea.
Mm-hmm.
And the guys that were from South Carolina, North Carolina, and Georgia were going crazy. They said, you can't believe the place that you're going to, you'll be... So, yes, Myrtle Beach was... We were very satisfied. Once I was there, I realized what they were talking about. But they had made offers to trade me assignments. He says, I'll do anything. They would give me something that they would like to trade for. But no, it was a very good assignment.
Oh, yeah. So then you went to Vietnam, right?
Right. And normally, I had been there since in May of 1966. to January of 1968. And normally when you are assigned an overseas assignment, you will get orders probably 30 to 45 days minimum so that you can prepare yourself for the assignment to move to. But what happened in January of 1968, the spy ship Pueblo, which was an American Navy ship, was captured off of the coast of North Korea. Their ship and their crew, and then their ship and their crew was taken to North Korea and became prisoners, which led us toward war. But also in 1968 was the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, to where they had a large force from North Vietnam and the Viet Cong to invade South Vietnam. So anyway, that's when we went to Vietnam.
And what was your role in Vietnam?
I was an auto technician. I also operated a wrecker that we call a tow truck today, but it was a big wrecker. It was recovery for anything from a car to a pickup truck to a tank.
Okay. And what, do you have like a craziest story from your time in Vietnam?
That's the craziest probably story. In January, and I think it was the 30th of 1968, the day before, which was like on a Sunday, one of my friends that lived on base called me, and at the time we were married, so he said, you know, there's something going on. There must be 25 cargo planes, Air Force cargo planes, and they're moving things, and there's all the aircraft are going. There was four squadrons at the air base, and three of them had left. So something's happening that, you know, that's different. So the next day, I go to work, and we report to our assignment, and the first thing they do is they have what's called a recall alert. And a recall alert is when the whole base goes on alert.
Yeah.
And it's because it's a TAC base, which is a tactical air command, you're supposed to be able to move in a short period of time. So on Monday, we became a tactical force, which I was a part of that in my squadron, and we would take goods and things to the base because I was in transportation and take it to their aircraft and load. So at the end of the day, they said, okay, we need five men to deploy. We can't tell you where or when you're going, but we have five people. So two of my friends, they said, you know, that's why we joined. Let's volunteer. So I did. So they said, okay, the next morning you need to report to the squadron headquarters, pick up your orders, and then they'll give you instructions from there. The first thing they do is now you need to go fill out a will because you're going to be going, and where you're going is to a combat zone. If you don't have one, you have to have one. Then you got to go to finance. You got to do this. Then report back to the hangar where you'll be leaving and marshaled at, and we'll give you instructions from there. So we did that. Sony took me out to the base, and we all got there, and we were all together. And they started naming off names, and they said, okay, everybody gets a rifle, an M16. Half of you people who are going one direction gets a winter parka. The other half, which I was in that half, you need to go back in this building and get a shot for the plague. So we knew we were headed someplace, but weren't sure. Yeah. We just knew that we were going to Southeast Asia or to Korea. And we knew pretty sure that without a Parker, we wouldn't be going there.
Yeah.
So we left there, and they sent us to Seymour Johnson Air Force Base, which was North Carolina, which is a MAC base. That's a military aircraft. Mm-hmm. It was a lot of turmoil at that time. But what would happen is we went up there by bus, and they didn't have any billets to put in. They say put us in the gymnasium. And that night, about 3 in the morning, you could hear a lot of rustling coming in. And we turned the lights on and said, where are you guys coming from? And where are you going? Well, we're going to Korea. And I said, wait a minute, you're coming from Kansas, but aren't you going the wrong way? We don't know, we're just going. So anyway, we were there at that base for a day and a half, and then we were put on a C-141, which is an Air Force cargo plane. We left probably at 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, and our next stop was in Anchorage, Alaska. A funny story was Sony's dad was a career Air Force.
Yeah.
When she took me to the base that day to leave, she says, well, this is probably just for practice. They used to do this to Dad, and they'd put him on a B-52.
Yeah.
And they'd go to the end of the runway and set, and then it would be over.
Yeah.
So I we stopped in Anchorage, Alaska, and had no contact with her until that time. So I call her. They had phones there.
Yeah.
And I said, Sony, I just want to let you know I'm in Alaska. And she, what do you mean you're in Alaska? So anyway, the next 3 days, which was different, we left Alaska. Then we went to Yokota Air Base in Japan. And then we stopped a little bit north of Japan, in Japan, at Itazuki, and dropped off a few of the guys that was going to Korea.
Mm-hmm.
We ended up in Kadena Air Base, Okinawa. Her mother and father was stationed in Naha Air Base, which is only 20 miles north of there. So the fellow, that one of my friends that I was with, he was actually at administration. And I told him, I said, you know, my mother and father-in-law are 20 miles away. Now, they have no idea I'm there. Mm-hmm. I said, I don't know how to get a hold of him. He said, will you give me his name and what organization he's in? I'll get a hold of him. So he got with administration, talked to his friends there at the base, and they got a hold of him and went and told him. He says, hey, says, Baker, your son-in-law's down at the base at Kadena. And he said, no, he's not there. He's in Myrtle Beach. He said, no, he's down there. So,
oh my gosh.
They had a car. So him and Sony's brother Bill and her mother came to Kadena and picked me up. So it was kind of crazy.
Yeah, that is crazy.
And we stayed there for one more night, and then they put us back on an aircraft. And on that Saturday, and we started on Monday, and this was Saturday, mm-hmm. but because of the congestion of everybody going different directions,
yeah.
with not only the Air Force, but the Army and the Marines and the Navy, we ended up at Phuket Air Base, North Vietnam, about 8:30 at night. So we, of course, you know, here it is. If you had some preparation, you always knew when you had an assignment where mm-hmm. you were going and yeah. what to expect. They would send you information.
They didn't do that.
They didn't do that.
That's crazy.
So the first thing we do, we unload from the plane. We go into base operations, and there's a, I think it was a major, that he's okay. Welcome to Phuket Air Base. You're really fortunate because this is the newest air base in Vietnam. It's one of the safest air bases.
Mm-hmm.
We've never had an attack. We've never had any insurgents on the ground, nor have we ever been hit with bombs, mortars, or anything like that. He said we had the North Korean ROC Army in the first perimeter. Then we had the U.S. Army as another perimeter. Then we had the United States Air Force security. Well, it starts to make you feel pretty good.
Yeah.
Man, I'm lucked out. So anyway, the first thing they do is to take your greenbacks. In other words, your money,
mm-hmm.
because our money is used in the black market there in Vietnam. It's worth so much more. So they take all your cash and turn it over to MPC, which is military pay currency. And they indoctrinate you on what is going on at the base.
Mm-hmm.
And then they say, okay, it's probably at 9:30 at night then, and we have an 8 for probably 8 hours. It's, we'll put you on a bus, and we're going to take you back and take your rifle, which you've carried with yourself since you left Myrtle Beach.
Yeah.
All this time you had it. But no, we're going to take it because you're not authorized to have a rifle or a weapon. Well, that was kind of strange. So anyway, we get back on the bus. They take us to, it was an officer's chow hall dining, mm-hmm. and they have midnight chow. So you go in and have food, come back out, and they have a guide that is going to take you to your billet for the mm-hmm. night. And fortunately, we had barracks that we could, with beds and everything. We didn't have to sleep in tents. So anyway, he said, okay, you guys from transportation and supply and this and this, all these different squadrons, you follow me. Well, in Vietnam, there's no street lights. The lights, it's blacked out at night mm-hmm. because those are targets for the enemy. So anyway, we're going to follow him. And we're, and you know, I can just barely see him, but I see him going. And all of a sudden, you can hear mortars dropping in, and in rockets, you can see things flashing. And then they have an air raid siren that goes off. He says, hit the bunker, hit the bunker. I said, wait a minute, what's a bunker? And where is the bunker? And he's running like crazy. What a bunker is, it's where you go when you have an attack with a rock or a mortar. It's like a shed that is reinforced with sandbags all the way around it and on top of it. So if it happens to hit, then it's not going to damage you. So anyway, the very first night we're there, we're told that we're at the safest base in Vietnam, and we get hit that night.
Oh my gosh.
So that's the craziest story.
Yeah.
The craziest story is how I started there and how I got there and the things that happened along the way and the first night we were there. So there for the next 6 months, about every 2 to 3 nights, the same thing happened. The sirens go off, the mortars and the rockets come in.
Yeah, interesting. Wow. So how long were you in Vietnam? How many years?
We were in 6 months.
6 months, okay.
It started out supposedly as a 90-day deployment, but it was extended to 90 more days, to 6 months total. They couldn't keep you there for one full term. Now, as soon as we got back, a lot of the guys that were there went back.
Okay. So what did that time in the service teach you?
Teaches a lot of responsibility. Mm-hmm. You go from being a young Hoosier farm boy, and you learn to be an adult, and you take a lot of responsibility.
Mm-hmm. So then what year was that when you returned?
I returned in 1970. Do you mean at home?
Did you return to Myrtle Beach, or where did you
return? No, returned to Myrtle Beach, yes. Okay. Right, in August of 1968, we came back to Myrtle Beach.
Okay, and then were you still in the military at that point then?
Yes, yes.
Okay, and then how much longer were you in the military?
I was discharged in April of 1970.
Okay, and then you came back?
Well, at the time, I was in the Air Force, and a friend of ours had offered Sony, my wife and I's job at a beach house, or it's a beach hotel right on the beach. So we moved into it, and we were staying there and managing the motel at night. And I was working at a gas station he was a guy that had got out of the Air Force before I did. He had bought, and I was working with him. So we stayed there through September of 1970, and we decided we'd come back to Indiana.
Okay.
So we pulled up stakes and came back to Indiana.
Nice. And then what did you do for your job once you came to Indiana?
Okay. When I got back here, I left 2 full-time jobs, and I had a difficult time finding a job. Yeah. My first job I got was at the glass factory in Dunkirk, and it was only temporary. It was just seasonal type work until people's vacations were done. So I worked there for 3 months, and then they laid me off. After that, I went to work for NCR, which is National Cash Register, and I was an apprentice. So I worked out of the Muncie office, and I actually went to training in Dayton.
Oh, cool.
So at that point, we had Shelley, which was one job, and Sony was pregnant for my second child, Elisa. Trying to live on an apprentice
was hard.
Pay was just not, wasn't working out. So what happened is, while I was in the service, I became very good friends with a guy that I worked with, and he and his father owned a parts store and machine shop in Hale Center, Texas. So all this time we kept in contact, and he had got out of the Air Force too, and he kept calling me. He said, look, I'm wanting to open a machine shop, and I need some help, and I know you can do it. Would you move to Texas? And we thought about it and thought about it, and finally said, well, he made me a good offer that I could become part of the business and be part owner. So we did. We moved to Texas.
We moved to Texas.
In March of 1971.
Really? So then you started this business in Texas, right?
And we lived there for 3 years.
Okay.
Elise was born, our second one. And everything went pretty good. And because I always call it the armpit of Texas because of in the High Plains area, in between Amarillo and Lubbock, a lot of sandstorms, a lot of tornadoes. You couldn't have an evening thunderstorm. It had to be a tornado.
Oh.
So anyway, it wasn't real pleasant. We had very good friends there, but the kids were growing up. Well, Shelley would have been starting kindergarten.
Okay.
And Sony said, you know, I wanted to start in Indiana to get an education there. So anyway, we came home in June of 1974. And before, when I came home, I couldn't find a job. Sony says, why don't you look around and see if there's anything open right now? So I did. I went to Muncie, and there was a parts store called Fleener's It was a national parts store, and I told them, you know, I might be coming back and look for a job. And they, I told me about, so I tell them what I've been doing. They said, yeah, well, if you want to come back, we'll have a job for you. Okay. So I thought, well, that'd be okay. Then I went down to a place called Nussbaum's Machine Shop on Centennial there in Muncie. Went in and talked to Andy, the owner, and he said, no, I'm not hiring right now. But yeah, I just talked, he's asked me what kind of work I did. Mm-hmm. He said, well, let's walk around. He showed me all his shop. By the time we came back to the front of the building, he says, you know, he says, I don't normally get people who have experience like you. So if you'd like to have a job, you come back, I'll hire you. Thought, well, that's pretty good. So then Sony had seen an ad in the paper for a service manager, automotive service manager, John Jackson, Chrysler, Plymouth, and Muncie.
Yeah.
So I went down and talked to John, and he was very favorable. And he said, I've got another guy I'm interviewing, but could you come back on Friday? I want to talk to you again. So I go back on Friday, and he said, well, he said, here's what I'll do. I'll make this offer to you, and if you can be back here in 2 weeks, the job is yours. I said, well, all my belongings are in Texas. We didn't come up here for the change. So I talked to Sony. She says, well, you know, you left this town with no job that was promising. And you have three jobs that you can come back to that you know that will pay you the money, you know, that you need.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, here it goes. So I called my friend there in Texas. I said, this is the deal. We're going to move back. He said, I understand. That's what you want to do. He said, I live where I was born and raised. So he said, I understand you. So I got a plane ticket, flew back to Texas. Sony's dad at that time and mom were stationed in Colorado Springs. So he came down, he helped me. We rented a U-Haul truck, brought all the belongings back to Indiana, and she had found a small house for us to live in temporarily until we could find something else. So from that point, I started work for John Jackson. He owned the dealership for 3 years. In 1977, he sold it to Bill Gaddis. Bill Gaddis was the sales manager.
Yeah.
And I was a service manager, and we had a sales assistant manager, and I worked there for 36 years.
All right. And so is that the last place you worked then before you retired?
Yes.
All right. And what was your favorite part about your job there?
I don't know that I'm a people person, but customers became friends. Over a period of 36 years, I met hundreds of people, and they became not only a customer, but they became friends. You know, they might buy 3 to 4 cars and have their cars worked on by our department over the years. That was my biggest accomplishment, you know, and I still have those friends today. Mm-hmm. It's been 10 years since I've retired, and I still have people call me who were customers that, you know, we want to go out to eat together. We want to, you know, I have questions for you, you know. So it was very enjoyable. Mm-hmm. During that time that I worked.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I'm about to graduate. Haley's about to graduate. What career advice would you give to someone like me who's about to enter the workforce shortly?
I think I would tell you or her to pick out an occupation or a career that you're very interested in and that you know that you're going to be happy for a long time once you choose that vocation, and understand you have and realize too you have to be capable of doing it, and that you're going to be successful and when you do choose that, because you know that you're going to do that for a very long time. If you do that, then you'll be satisfied. It's when you go to a job that you really don't like, and you hear so many people today, I hate my job, I would never
do something
want
else
it.
Yeah.
it just makes life hard.
Oh, yeah. All right, we're going to transition now to talk about some family things.
Sure.
So how did you meet your wife?
We went to school together. Mm-hmm. Her sister was the same age and same grade that I was. So we kind of grew up together as friends. And then after a while, it kind of became girlfriend, boyfriend.
Yeah.
And then later on, it became more serious.
Oh, yeah. So what was your first date?
First date as we can remember, and Sonya and I talked about it, we really can't remember, but what we did a lot was when high school and I played basketball, after the basketball game, you'd go to Muncie and go to Clara's or the Pizza King and have pizza. Uh-huh. And I think that may have been our first one, actual date.
Yeah. And How would you describe her to someone who didn't know her?
She's very compassionate. She's very personable. She's very friendly. As her grandchildren will tell you, she knows everybody, and she likes to stop and talk to everybody. Mm-hmm. And she's a very loving and caring wife, mother, grandmother.
Mm-hmm. And how did you know that she was like the one you wanted to marry?
We spent 3 years together, and I decided that, you know, before I went in the Air Force, that if I left, I was going to be gone for 4 years, that I wanted her to be with me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And did you ask her dad for permission?
Well, her dad wasn't available. Her dad he was still in Okinawa.
Oh.
So at our wedding, her grandmother and grandfather, who she was living with, I guess I no doubt asked them.
Okay. And how did you ask her to marry you?
Well, here again, I think we were just sitting in front of her grandmother's house talking about what we were going to do, because at that time I was in college and she was in high school. And I said, you know, eventually we're probably going to get married. So would you like to marry me? And she said, yes.
And so then when did you get married? What's your anniversary?
October 8th, 1966. Last October 8th, we were married 55 years.
Oh my goodness, congrats. So obviously that's been a very long time. What would you say is the key to that successful long marriage?
When you marry somebody, it's husband and wife, but also it's your very best friend. You have to realize that you're going to spend a lot of time together, and you have to be understanding and compassionate with her needs and your needs.
Mm-hmm. So then how many kids do you two have?
I'm sorry?
You two have two or three kids?
We have three children.
Three children.
Shelly's my oldest, and she's 52. Elisa, who lives in Las Vegas, is 50. And then Derek, who lives in Albany, is 44.
All right. And how old were you when your first child was born and your last child?
I was 22 years old when Shelly was born, and I was 30 when Derek was born.
Okay. Do you have any funny parenting stories that stick out from when they were little?
I'm sure there's a lot of funny things, but I guess one of the funniest things, which they still think it's funny, growing up, when I'd get a scratch or a boo-boo or, you know, a cut on my hand, my mother would always say, okay, let's get the methylate out and put methylate, and it burns like crazy. So I always had methylate that I could put on my children when they had cuts, and they all said, no. But now they do the same thing and to their children, and they laugh when they do it. Plus the fact my mother, you know, who told me, and then my children and my grandchildren, and I impressed them, in the wintertime, you always have to have a toboggan, and you have to have mittens, and you have to have a scarf to put on before you, and that's until you're 18, and then you can decide whether you want to or not.
Oh, interesting. What lesson would you say that you stressed the most to your kids when they were growing up?
I want them to be honest. I want them to be polite. I want them to be good kids. And if they were good kids, they would have a good life later.
Mm-hmm. And what do you think is the most rewarding part about being a parent?
Is seeing your children from the time they were babies to when they become children, to young adults, to adults, and also your grandchildren, and seeing them turn out good and seeing them to be in our likeness, like us.
Yeah. And what would the Dennis Wilson of today tell himself as a young husband and father?
I would tell them that if you are a good husband to your wife, and if you're a good father to your children and to your grandchildren, you will have a good reward in life.
And then how many grandkids do you have?
I've got 5 grandchildren, 3 girls and 2 boys.
And you want to name them off?
We have Hannah, who is 26, and she lives in Virginia, and she has her own home. She raises horses, and she works at a job contracted by the government. Then we have Tanner, who's married, and he works for a company in Portland that deals in grain. He's married to a girl who is a registered nurse. Mm-hmm. Then I have Haley, who is a student at Ball State.
Mm-hmm.
And she has a very good friend named Andy.
Yeah.
And she's pretty good girl. Then Cameron, who he is 16, plays football, is now wrestling, and he's going to be the big boy.
Yeah.
I think once a month he grows an inch and 10 pounds. And then I have Kinley, who is 11 years old, but she's in the other room, and she goes to Red Key, and she's in the fifth grade.
All right. And what is your favorite part about being a grandpa?
Ooh, seeing them grow up and being able to go see their activities. Tanner played baseball for 4 years. I was able to go watch him play baseball. Cameron's now playing. He played baseball also, so I got to go to his games. And now he's playing football, which I'm so proud of him for that. And seeing Kinley in the school activities. When I worked for 36 years, my hours were very long. I'd go to work at 7 o'clock in the morning, and I might not get home till 7 or 8 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
So I missed a lot of the activities of my children. So I made it a point that I would go see, after I retired, see all the, and be with all the kids in their activities.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome. And I know that, I mean, you have the picture of you all in Myrtle Beach behind you. You lived there for a while. I didn't even realize that.
Yeah.
So next we're going to talk about some vacations. So when did you start taking your entire family to Myrtle Beach?
From the time that our children were young, in other words, after we moved back to Indiana, and probably maybe 2 years after we lived there in Albany, we started taking our family vacation back to Myrtle Beach. And that's continued on since 1977, 78. Now, we, in the last probably 10 years, every other year, we will rent a beach house big enough for 13 to 15 kids, mm-hmm. 15 people, and they all come down and spend a week at the beach. The favorite place to be is Myrtle Beach. The kids will say the same thing. Sony's mother lives in Florida, and this past summer we went down and spent a week in Anna Maria Island, which is very, very nice, right off the coast of Florida on the Gulf Coast. But still, it's not like having your family there with you.
Oh, yeah.
We also had a lake house for 20 years near Syracuse, and it was fun. But the greatest enjoyment that we have is going to Myrtle Beach.
And do you have any particular memories that stand out or like favorite things about going back there?
The favorite things, I guess, is being able to go back and see the Air Force Base to where they have changed it from an Air Force Base. The runway itself is now the city airport. They use the same runway.
Oh, really?
And on the other side, there's a few of the buildings that are still there. The building that I worked in is still there on the base, and they've turned it into the fire department. But the rest of the base, they've turned it into a small town. And going back there, seeing that, the old base, and then we still have a friend who we were in the military with,
oh.
Her and her family, which our kids are the same age. We see her every time we go back down. So knowing the lay of the land, knowing all the area of the Myrtle Beach, and we stay on the south end, which is Garden City, Surfside. We know where to go.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot nicer than if you go to a new place where you kind of have to search around.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And where did you say your lake place was?
Just outside of North Webster.
Okay.
It was the lake next to Tippecanoe.
And what caused you to get a lake place when you did?
Well, we started out on Little Chapman Lake, and had a house trailer. Sony's mom and dad bought a trailer, and they went up and they would go there. You know, he was still working, still on the weekends. So we'd go up there and spend the weekend with them. Well, we decided we liked it real well, so we bought a small trailer.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know how long we lasted in the first trailer, but then we found another trailer that was closer to the channel, so we bought it. And then we found another trailer, and the people up there, which on Little Chapman, were mainly from Albany, Dunkirk, Hartford City, some people from Columbia City and Huntington. Mm-hmm. But they were all people from this area, so we knew all of them. It was a lot of fun to go up on the weekend. And while I was working, we could leave on Friday night and be up there in 2 hours, and then spend till Sunday evening, and we come back at 7 o'clock in the evening. But the reason we went up there, and we decided that we wanted to be lake people.
Mm-hmm.
So one of our friends from Albany had a lot or had a house on Dewart Lake, and Dewart mm-hmm. Lake is where we ended up at. And we told him sometime if you have, you see something come open, we'd like to be interested in it. So he called us and he said, hey, he says, the lot next to me is going up for sale, and it's got an old house trailer on it.
Mm-hmm.
And you probably don't, you're not I don't think you'd want to refurbish it. You'd probably want to take it down.
Yeah.
So we went up, made a deal with the people that owned that, took the house trailer, had it moved off, and then had a house put on the lot. And we were there for probably, I'm trying to think, in that particular house, we were probably there a good 16 years before we sold it.
Yeah. And do you have any particular memories that stand out from your time on the lake?
Just the kids. Yeah. Kids, bringing the kids up. You know, always on Memorial Day, we put the boat in the water, have a barbecue, and most times you could have snow, you could have sleet, or you could have sun on Memorial Day. it was fun. And everybody asked, you know, why did you sell it after I retired? We sold it, and it was okay. It would have been nice, but it became another house to take care of, another lot to take care of. Yeah. And we decided we'd rather travel.
Yeah.
And that's what we've done.
Mm-hmm. And where all have you traveled?
Well, we spent a lot of time in the South. Sony's mother and brother lives outside of Bradenton, Florida. And we normally spend at least 2 months down there every year. Our middle daughter, Alisa, lives in Las Vegas, Nevada. Yeah. So every other year, we take off in the fall and go down there probably for at least 2 to 3 mm-hmm. weeks. And we have friends from Texas where we go visit them. And South Carolina, and my granddaughter lives in Virginia. We go mm-hmm. over and spend a week with them. So
yeah, that's awesome.
Nothing outside the United States, but
yeah,
inside.
But still fun. Yeah. So what year did you retire then?
2010.
And what made you retire? It was just time?
At 2010, I was 63 years old. I was still in very good health.
Yes.
I feel like I'm still in good health now.
Yeah.
And I had seen too many people work too many years and not be able to enjoy retirement. So
yeah.
Sony was still working, my wife, and we decided we could get by with what I didn't have a retirement. I had made my own retirement, but I decided we could retire and she would go to part-time and then we could start traveling
yeah.
and start doing the things like we wanted to,
uh-huh.
which we do now.
Yeah, awesome. And so what is your typical day like right now?
In the summertime, what I try to do, and I've been lax lately, but I used to get up, have coffee, take off and go for a walk here and try to walk maybe 3 miles for exercise. And in the summertime, the lawn, I try to keep my lawn very nice, plant flowers, lots of flowers,
mm-hmm.
and that upkeep. And that's pretty much in the summertime. In the wintertime, I have I would call a man cave out in our pole barn, okay? And I have a treadmill and a lot of exercise equipment, and I go out there in the morning and try to do at least 45 minutes. And then, here again, in the man cave, it's kind of like a shop where I have always something, some kind of a
project
that I work with.
Awesome.
To keep active.
Oh, yeah, that's good. So you've done great so far. We're getting to the final stretch here. So, yeah, see, it's not too hard just talking about yourself. But you've obviously, did you say you are 75 or you're going to be 75?
I am 75.
You are 75. So you've lived 75 years here on this earth. What do you think of the world right now?
I'm very concerned.
Yeah.
I'm very, very concerned. And to be real honest, and I feel like our government is being controlled by some very corrupt and evil people. And people might say that I'm an activist, but I'm not. But I can see what my life has been like for 75 years, and I can see what it's like right now. The things that are being done by the government right now is not right. What I learned as I grew up and as I went into the military, I learned things, and I was very proud of the country that I live in. And these people are trying to change that, and I don't think they're trying to change it for what is right. They're changing things that shouldn't be changed. But I think little by little, the mistakes that they're making, the majority of people see it, and mm-hmm. they're not going to put up with it.
Yeah. So as you look back on your 75 years of life, who are the people who have influenced you or impacted you the most? What do you say?
To begin with, probably my wife, my mother and father, my children, my grandchildren, but also a lot of people who I was in the military with who are still very, very good friends today. They helped shape me, I guess, with the knowledge that I had to do the things that are right. And by doing that, I feel like I've been very successful to myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And do you have a favorite memory or time period of your life?
I guess watching my kids being born and my grandchildren and watching them grow. Mm-hmm. That, and it's continuous, and I wouldn't change that for anything.
Yeah. And would you say that you have like a worst time in your life or hardest?
Probably the worst time of my life was when my father passed away. I was 17 and I graduated from high school, and 2 weeks later he passed away from, he had Lou Gehrig's disease, and he had a real tough time the last year.
Mm-hmm. And if you mind me asking, like, how did you mentally like get through that time?
Probably my mother helped me, but then I decided that it's time for me to be an adult. I was going to have to take my brother had moved away. He lived in Iowa, and my sister had gotten married, and she had her own life. And I decided I'm going to have to be the man of the house.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry to hear that. Do you regret anything?
You know, I don't. When I saw that question, I thought, you know, what would I regret? I can't think of anything that I regret doing. I've been very successful with my occupation that I had. I've been very happy to have the family that I have. I can say that they're good kids. They're good grandkids. I'm not rich by no means, but I've had everything I've ever wanted. So mm-hmm. I don't have any regrets.
Yeah, that's awesome. And what advice would you give to my generation?
To look at things the way they are today and not believe everything that's being told. You're going to have to try to do your best to be a good person, be understanding to other people's needs, and to be successful, you're going to have to stay on the right side of the tracks.
Mm-hmm. And what do you believe is the most important thing in life?
To me, is your family, my family. Mm-hmm. And it's... Yeah, so far it's worked out pretty good.
Yeah. And one more question. What do you hope to be remembered by?
As a good son, as a good father, a good husband, a good, and my grandchildren, a good soldier, and a good person, mm-hmm. and a good friend to everybody.
Dennis Wilson, a humble, genuine, and hardworking man. He has a quiet confidence about him, causing each word he speaks to hold even that much more importance. He's lived his life with no regrets and says that he's had everything he's ever wanted. He hopes to be remembered as being a good son, soldier, husband, father, grandfather, and friend to everybody. And he definitely will be remembered as those things. Dennis says that the most important thing in life is family. He says that for him, so far, it's worked out pretty good.
I think that's all the questions I have, unless there's anything else you want to add? Or...
No, I don't think so.
Awesome. You did great.
I did.
Yes, you did. You did so well. Yeah. You didn't even have to use your notes, really.
Yeah.
I bet it helped just like writing it all out, though.
It is. Like I said, there's things I'm sure I overlooked there, but I think I told you everything.